once we see a different level of understanding, but we have that within us, we can relate everything to it. So now when we have unity consciousness, for instance, that means that we do not believe anymore in this optical illusion that we're all separate. Because in meditation we have actually experienced the fact that we're not. That there is one creation. And don't think of a creator. Just think of a creation. You can see that creation. All you have to do is look. It's everywhere. And we're part of this creation. And this creation doesn't mean that there are bits and pieces everywhere. It's one. And in meditation, we do feel that. We feel that oneness. And we lose the boundaries. The boundaries which we put around the body, and we also put around time. We have boundary in time. Past, present, future. Three types of time. And because we always have that, we don't live in the present. And when we don't live in the present, we don't live at all. Because what we're doing is we're trying to remember what was in the past, and we're trying to project what's going to be in the future, instead of living what's in the present. But if we live in this present moment, and this is another thing we learn from meditation, we actually become acquainted with eternity. Because each moment that we live is always a moment followed by a moment. And as we have each moment as our life experience, there's nothing else. There's no past, there's no future. It just is. And then we have lost the boundary of time, and we've lost the boundary of this body. And although it looks exactly the same as it did before, everybody looks the same as before, we know differently. And if we know differently, we can then use the Buddha's teaching to try and understand what he means by the fact that we're all living in an illusion of self. And the insight wisdom which the Buddha talks about, which is the goal of the practice, consists of three bits, three parts, three characteristics: anicca, dukkha, anatta, the impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness, and the corelessness of all that exists. Now we can pick one of those three and investigate, but without having a feeling for the fact that the way we think in everyday life is too limited. Without that, our understanding of those three characteristics will also be too limited. They will be intellectual. And although an intellectual understanding is very helpful, it's much more than most people have. It doesn't change one's character. It's got to be an inner feeling. And when it becomes an inner feeling that I am totally impermanent, absolutely transient, really translucent and not solid, there's no fear of death. And when there's no fear of death, there's no fear at all. Because that's what we're all afraid of. Even though we may not admit it, it doesn't matter. We're afraid of annihilation. Whether we say we're afraid of men or women or dark or spiders or snakes or whatever we may be afraid of, doesn't matter. It's all the same thing. We're afraid of annihilation. And once we've seen that there's nobody there to be annihilated, all fear goes. And only when fear goes can we really live in a sense of peace, in a sense of inner security, in a way of real lovingness towards others, because they're not other. They're me. Or they're as much me as I'm me. And only then comes there that kind of peacefulness that people usually look for in the meditation, and which we can get temporarily in the meditation, but solidly only when we have seen how very transient everything is. I always recommend that one should have one of those little clocks that move all the time. What do you call these things? These digital things, digital clocks. You look at it and you see everything moves. And we think the time is moving and we are standing still. What nonsense. We're moving just as much as the little digital clock is moving, right with it. And on an ordinary clock, you can't see it that well. I mean, it moves too, but it isn't quite as noticeable. But on a digital clock, you can't avoid it. And we move along. It's like sitting in a train, and you look out the window, and you think that the whole scenery is moving, and you're sitting still. The train's going too, isn't it? And you're moving with it. It's the same with the clock. We're moving along. And once you see that, and once you feel it, not knowing, that's the first step. We've got to understand it and know it. That's the first step, very important. But then when you feel it, then you feel everything differently. And as you feel things differently, you can actually let go of all the things within which are burdensome. You can let them go. Everything that one would like to be, that one isn't, or that one is and wouldn't like to be, or that others are and one doesn't want them to be, or that others are not and we'd like them to be. I mean, all these things that we all deal with all the time, huh? You know, we look at it and say, well, it's all moving. Next moment, they'll be different, and they will be. Quite certainly so. And when you have that overview, which is an overview, it's like a bird's eye view. You look sort of from above at the whole thing which is moving. It doesn't have the kind of sting that otherwise our daily happenings most of the time have for us. And why do they sting? Because we think there's somebody sitting inside that really has to be protected, that really has to have things the way we have figured them out. We have made an imaginary life for ourselves. We imagine the way things are. And because reality and imagination never meet, we can never be totally satisfied. We need to look at it and see, is it true? It's no use saying, oh yeah, that's all true, finished. Or saying, it's all untrue. That's not the way I am at all, finished. That's no good either. Neither the affirmative nor the doubt are any use. The only thing to do is to contemplate it. Really try to go inside and see, is it like that? Do I have that? Is the Buddha telling me how to get rid of these uncertainties, difficulties, fears, dislikes, reactions? Can I do it? And if the answer is yes, there's nothing else to do but practice. Practice is the only thing that really matters. Everything else is just sort of extraneous matter. But practice is the one thing that matters. So in the first instance, just to recapitulate, in the first instance, we see and look at our behavior in daily life and see whether we're satisfied with it and contented with it. We can't meditate if we're not contented. We would like to become contented because of our meditation, but we have to bring contentment to the meditation pillow. Joy is a very important factor, a prerequisite for meditation. We're happy about the way we have been going. That's our first step. The second is to try to become concentrated. What do we have to do in order to become concentrated? Well, most of you know, you've got to let go of all that thinking. How do we do that? Well, by recognizing the fact that the thinking is the world as we know it, and we'd like to transcend that. we'd like to become aware of a higher dimension and tell that to oneself again and again and again until the mind eventually believes it. It's a very set in its habitual ways of thinking, but eventually it does believe it if it's told often enough. The same with the loving kindness. If it's told often enough to love other people, it finally says, well, all right, then I'll try. You know? In the beginning it says, oh, I can't love that person, impossible. But in the end, the mind sort of says, well, okay, then I'll give it a go. And it's the same with this, with the concentration. Eventually, the mind does become tired of all this thinking. It's very tiring. Thinking is extremely tiring with dukkha. And no need for it at all. So that's our second step, to get the mind unified, concentrated, to have it in a such a way that you can't shake it. It becomes imperturbable. And the Buddha calls it also, when it becomes concentrated, malleable, flexible, and so that it can see further than before. And having done that, then we have a look. What we can actually see, which goes far beyond of what is within our optics, far beyond what is within our thinking, because it is an inner realization. And as we get that, our whole being changes. One can say that we are what we put our mind on. Well, check it out and see, where do you put your mind? That's what we are. And people, many people, quite rightly so, would like to be helpful to others. It's a nice thing to do, and it's very important. But we can only help others as far as we've already helped ourselves. Whatever we find within us, that we can give to others. You know, when the Buddha spoke, people were able to become enlightened hearing one Dhamma talk. We have his Dhamma talks. So it's not the words, is it? The Dhamma talks are there. They are translated into English, no problem at all. So it's not the words at all. It's what comes out of a person. It's that emanation that came from the Buddha. It's that emanation of each one of us that changes our surroundings and that changes the world. So if we would like to have a better quality of life for ourselves and for everything else that is around us, the inner change will do that. I think you've been patient long enough, listened long enough. If you have any questions, you can ask me questions.
I have a question about that third state was used to identify the first one as see and look and be contented. So the second one as strong self is thinking. What was the third state?
I'm not at the moment relating quite well to what you're saying. The first stage was moral conduct.
I don't know, not from the seal as well, but it was brain when you told me about meditation.
Ah, okay.
I identified three stages. The first one you said was to see and look and to be content and pure, that type of thing. The second one you said was transcend thinking, not to intellectual activity, but transcend that. But you said there were three.
Yes, and then you come to, I said, unity consciousness, right? Yes, yes. Anything else?
Isn't there people who are aware of the spirituality and the morality? Do you not think that they are becoming greater than the moment?
It seems that way to me, but I often wonder, because you see, I compare that to a doctor. a doctor sits in his office and all he sees are sick people. So he must be thinking everybody's sick, right? And all I see are people who want to learn to meditate. So I must be thinking everybody wants to learn to meditate, you know, but it's not true. But truthfully so, yes, I am convinced, actually. I am convinced that there is an increase, yes. Well, the numbers that I was mentioning in Germany, I have never met before anywhere, you know, that many people. And not that these people all want to practice. They come out of curiosity too, you know. But there are more and more people practicing, that's true, but it's still not enough. Yeah.
I remember when in Germany last year, I stayed at one station and jumped to the conclusion after a lot of thinking that Nirvana equals God.
Well, not God as an anthropomorphic figure, of course. I mean, obviously. And I think most people who think about God and have a fair to middling intelligence are not thinking about a person there. Although, you'd be surprised how many people do. How many people do think about a personal God. The word God is just a word, it's just a concept. And if you think of it as the underlying reality out of which everything springs, but which it can only spring out of it if there is the craving to be, which is creation, then we can come to that understanding that Nibbana is the underlying reality, but it can only be the personal manifestation if there is that desire to be. And that's why God is also equated to creator, but that's the wrong way of thinking of it. It is creation is there, but no creator. And if you think of God as the whole of it, everything, nothing excluded, universe after universe after universe, galaxy after galaxy after galaxy, nothing excluded, and not anything in it, only in it when it wants to be in it, when it wants to manifest, when something wants to manifest, and we come to Nibbana. That's Nibbana. Well, Meister Eckhart, whom I usually use as to quote from, said, God exists because the creature exists, which is the personal God, right? But behind God is the Godhead. And so he's using the word Godhead as that which is overshadowing everything, consisting of everything. And he also, one of his main teaching, or the main teaching, was to let go of the I, of the me. That was his main teaching. And if you let go of the me, then God finds room to be. As soon as you let go of me, God finds room to be. There's a very beautiful poem by him. And as soon as you let go of me, Nibbana finds room to be. Yeah.
In the, a lot of the writings of Chomdong Trungpa, I don't know if that's quite well, he talked about this idea of basic goodness, that everyone has a basic goodness. Do you agree with that, and what do you think this basic goodness is?
Well, I don't need to agree or disagree, but I can just go back to the Buddha's words. He said we're born with six roots, three good ones and three bad ones, wholesome and unwholesome. The unwholesome ones are greed, hate and delusion, and the wholesome ones are love, generosity and wisdom. And all of us are born with all six. We all have all of them.
When you say born, you mean born, not created?
Born, when we appear out of the mother's womb.
Right.
Yeah. And it's our choice which one of these roots we strengthen and which one of these roots we try to eliminate or try to minimize. If we become aware of them, that we do something about them. And if we finally come to the stage where we understand that, you know, it's all a mistake, because delusion is the mistaken view of me, then the hate and greed disappear, and then you have only the good ones left. So everybody's got everything. It's a choice we make. Now also these choices are karmic resultants. However, they're not fate. We have free will. We can choose. And so it's a matter of awareness. And people are terribly deluded sometimes to think what is good and what is not good, of course, because we don't see so clearly. But it's quite right, you know, everybody's got the goodness, but everybody's got the badness too, unfortunately. So, yes. Why don't people practice? Yeah, well, that's a good question. I'd like to know too. I don't understand it myself. It's effort. Let's put it that way. I think the main culprit is the third hindrance, sloth and torpor. You know, lie down and watch television or something like that. And you really are never comfortable. I mean, you're comfortable for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and then you have to do something else, and you know, it's. I mean, I can see it so clearly watching these two little kids, you know. It's really very enlightening. They've got all the dukkha in the world, and their parents try with all their might to reduce the dukkha. But no way. No way. Not possible. You know, there's always dukkha. Yeah, why don't people practice? It's amazing, isn't it? And you know, the most amazing thing that I find is that even those people who have had some success in their meditation don't practice. And that I find even more amazing. I mean, if you've never had a moment of concentration and then you get fed up and frustrated, I can understand that, right? You need a pep talk by somebody. But if you've been quite all right in your meditation, it went quite well, and then you stop. I don't understand that at all. I have no understanding why this happened. And if I ask the person who it happens to, they can't explain it either. So it must be that third hindrance, sloth and torpor. Yes. Oh, you mean because people's minds are so convoluted, they need something which is far more complicated. Yeah, well, they can read the Abhidhamma. That's as convoluted as you can get. There's nothing to stop them. It's all in English. It's available. Seven volumes of it. Yeah.
As I see, what you have in the Dhamma is not creation but happening. Happening is because of the anterior causes. And if you look at things like the universe and things you're talking about, it's not a creation that you are looking at, but simply a happening which is also always changing. So I think the word creation is somewhat unfortunate to use in reference to the Buddha, because the Buddha's whole idea was that there is no creation.
No, there's no creator. The word creation is happening. It's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah, except that creation implies somebody who's an author of the creation.
No. That's the kind.
Why use the controversial word? Why not call happening?
No, I do it on purpose because I like for people to break through the kind of thinking that they have been doing because of, well, actually being brainwashed into that way. The word creation is a perfectly good word without a creator. When you think of it that there is something created, which means it's happening. It's the same thing. It doesn't, you see, it has, well, the word God has a connotation. The word love is heavily, it has a really heavy meanings for everybody. A God, creation, creator. But it's not necessary. When we see the things as they really are, these are just words and concepts. And we can use them. In Europe, where nobody's really a Buddhist, I only talk to Catholics, it's very important that you use their language and show them that it's the same thing.
Yeah, but that also imports a lot of baggage with it, you see. The whole word God and what you talk about, Maisteka, the interpretation of God as well, Zalba Pim or some abstract thing. But that is not the way that I would teach this Muhammad, they spoke for God. But then God was always an anthropomorphic person, you see. You are sitting up there in heaven.
Yeah.
So when these people use the same word to denote a different concept, they are into obscuring the meaning. I think they should use find a different word. For their ground of being or whatever they use. Because that confusion is actually used by people who believe in theistic religion and so on. That when they get into a corner, they say, no, we're not looking at the anthropomorphic thing. We are looking at this ground of being or the ultimate basis of reality. But when they go into their churches and things, they forget all about that and they start praying to this being who is sitting somewhere up there. This is so
well, it's not my experience. Not my experience at all. The people who come to listen to me are totally frustrated by the church. They've had it. They don't want to go anymore. They have heard it since they were, as you say in Australia, knee-high to a grasshopper, and they can no longer stand it because it doesn't make sense. And if I am able to make sense out of their confusion, they are extremely grateful. They find that the greatest help. You have a different approach. You are what is known as a born Buddhist. And that is a totally different story altogether. That's totally different. I must say that in Sri Lanka, I was several times told that how could I know what the Dhamma is? I wasn't a born Buddhist. Well, it didn't bother me at all. But when you deal with people like I deal with who are, well, Catholics more so than Protestants, who feel guilty about having left the church and not going back there anymore and not making sense out of the whole thing and feeling pretty negative about what they've been told, they feel so relieved when they find out that actually it does make sense. All they have to do is practice and they'll find out themselves. It's a different approach. And I've never been Catholic. I've been Jewish, but even that was nothing. I never practiced anything. But I have the Western approach, you know, the non-Buddhist approach, so to say. And Christian mystics, which I have read to some extent, have given me have given me an insight into the possibilities that exist in Christianity. They're there. Teresa de Avila, Meister Eckhart, Francisco de Osuna, all these people knew exactly what was going on. They had exactly the right understanding. They used different terminology. So when you speak to people like I do, who use that different terminology but can't make any sense out of it, it helps them a great deal to find out that there is some sense to it. It doesn't take them back to the church. Not at all. In fact, it makes them more solidly grounded in practicing Buddhism. You see, I tell them also something else. I tell them that the word Buddhist and the word Buddhism was never used by the Buddha. It's a much later invention. The Buddha used the word practitioner, and he used the word Dhamma. And so it's not necessary to become a Buddhist in order to practice. And I've told them that over and over again. And you know, I have 150 or 160 people in a meditation course, and I give refuge at the end of it. And all 150 take it. After I've told them they don't have to be Buddhists. Because that is what attracts them, that they don't have to. Because by the Catholic Church they were told they had to. Whatever it was that they had to, I don't know exactly what they had to. So it's a different thing. I don't tell them that they don't have to be Buddhist to make them find it appealing. I tell them that because I mean it. I have never said anything that I didn't mean. I can't do it. I really mean it. But it's a different approach. It's and this is probably the reason why I wound up in Germany. You know? Because I have that kind of understanding. And, that makes sense? Yeah. And you know, another thing which irked me all the years has been, and it doesn't irk me anymore, but it used to. I used to listen to some Western monks, Theravadan monks, and they used to say, and I remember it like it was yesterday, although it's 10 years ago and more. They used to say that in Christianity, there's absolutely no way that you can have any insight, because you always have to have this union, and you have to be there, and there's always God, and so you can't ever gain proper insight. And it used to irk me, and I used to think that can't be so. Until I started reading the mystics, the Christian mystics. I could never agree with that feelingly, but I didn't know enough at the time to argue, besides what's the use of arguing. And but I always felt something wrong there, that isn't right. All religions have the same goal. Now you see, for instance, Islam. It's a really militaristic religion, isn't it? But Sufism is their mystic part. And I'm real good friends now with Pir Inayat Khan. He writes me pages and pages of letter discussing the most, how shall I say, subtle mental formations and asking questions. And so I try to answer. And he has exactly the same goal that we have. And it's not like Islam at all. It's Sufism, you know. So if there is a truth, there's only one. There can't be many. There's only one. And I compare truth to to a mountain and to the summit. Truth is the summit of this mountain. Now you might decide that you're going to climb this mountain on the west side, the east side, the north or the south. Doesn't matter. Whatever you happen to be told is the best way to get up there. But up there on top, that's it. Once you're on top, you see the world the same way everybody else does. It's on top. There are several ways to get up there, sure, because some people live in the west and some live in the north and some southeast. Several ways to get up there. I think the Buddhist way is the easiest and best way to get up there, but because it's so explicit, we know what to do. But that doesn't mean that the other ways don't get you there. They do. A lot of people are trying to what? Different mountains, yes. Well, they get confused, sure. Yes. Yeah.
I think it's not part of the question that we don't really know what our religion teaches.
That's right.
Because Christianity, if you read the 14th chapter of the Gospel according to St. John, the Lord Jesus said, I am in the Father is in me, and I am in you. You are God.
That's right.
You are the Father. But not many Christians ever read that bit. They just slide over it because it's too difficult. But the whole of that chapter is the bit, my opinion, the core of the mysticism of the Christian church.
You don't even have to read it. All you have to do is meditate and you'll know it.
Yes.
You know? But if you then read it after you've meditated, you think, oh, that's nice. They're even saying it, you know.
The militant Christians say that this is nonsense. They don't even read their own books.
Yeah.
They don't even follow their own map.
There have been some dispute on the identity of the Dawn's Gospel, but then people say that that is a later theological version.
Not your committed Christian. It's God's word, therefore I have to believe it. They don't believe it.
Yeah, but the thing is that if there was a detailed method for people to follow, they would soon get to the understanding, you know. Okay, have we exhausted the questions? All right. We'll attend to the breath for just a few moments. Watch it going in and out of the nostrils to quieten the mind. And now, imagine that you have a beautiful flower garden growing in your heart. The most gorgeous blooms, lovely aroma. All growing in the soil of a loving heart. And tended with care. And as you find yourself in the flower garden of your heart, you're happy, contented, and you feel loving and caring because there's so much beauty within you. And now we'll make the most beautiful bouquet that we can think of. Different colors, aromas, different blooms, just as beautiful as we can make it. And hand it with love to the person sitting nearest you. And we'll think of our parents, whether they're still alive or not. And we find the most beautiful flowers in our heart. and given to them as a present. And we see the joy that this provides for them. And we think of those people who are nearest and dearest to us, those that we might live with, and for each of them we prepare a beautiful bunch of flowers out of our garden in the heart, grown in love, tended with care, and given as a present, showing that we feel our togetherness and want to make the other people happy without expecting to get anything back. And we think of our good friends and acquaintances and relatives. Everyone who comes to mind, and for each of them, we collect the most beautiful flowers we can find in our heart and hand it to them with love and care and concern for their well-being. And we can see that the more flowers we give away, the more of them grow in our heart. Now we think of those people whom we meet in our everyday life. People we work with, or neighbors, or people in shops, on the street. Whoever comes to mind, who is part of our daily happening, and for each of them, make a beautiful bouquet of flowers, grown in love, tended with care, given as a present, to show our togetherness, to show that we're thinking of them in a loving way. We think of someone whom we find very difficult, whom we've been angry at, or who's been angry at us, or if we don't have anybody like that in our life, then someone whom we feel quite neutral about. And for this person also, we get the most beautiful flowers out of the flower garden in our heart and present them with love. And if there's been somebody who we've been angry at, we can feel the anger dissipating, the difficulty dissolving. And now we open our heart as wide as we can and allow as many people into the flower garden of our heart as possible. First, we let everyone in who is here. And each one can take one of the beautiful flowers as a sign of our lovingness. And we can see each time flowers are removed, we have many more growing because we give them away in love. And love makes them grow. And then we let all the people in.